The rise of an American Jewish intelligentsia began with the influx of Jewish immigrants who crowded into New York at the turn of the 19th century, bringing many young people with ambitions of becoming writers and creative thinkers, as was natural for a people that ascribed the highest value to intellectual activity. The newspaper was itself a hybrid form of information and entertainment, commerce and ideology, persuasion and accommodation, individual expression for the mass market. The Yiddish newspaper had further to negotiate between the European past and the American present, between staying Jewish and becoming American. This is a kind of prequel, because the term the New York intellectuals was either coined by Irving Howe, or in any case, it was used by Irving Howe to describe the intellectuals who come later than the ones that I will be speaking about in this series. And the term is used for people who are very, you know, still, I believe, pretty well known, like Irving Kristol, like Saul Bellow, Isaac Rosenfeld, and certainly Norman Podhoretz and Midge Dekter and others. But I became interested in trying to trace back this phenomenon much earlier, because in fact, there was a group of intellectuals, as it happened, in New York, from the end of the 19th century, and they worked in Yiddish. And at some point, there were meetings of the two, but that happened later. And I think that these earlier thinkers, not all of them in these series are going to be Yiddish thinkers. Kahn, as you will see, is the great crossover man. But the two lectures that I will be giving in the next 2 weeks are of Yiddish poets, very fascinating people. Then others who are bilingual, really. And in any case, a different cohort. So this is just to give you some of the background, and the person I'm thinking about today is, would have been, truly one could have said about him, this man needs no introduction. It was literally true of Ab Kahn in the first half of the 20th century, so much so that the sociologist Nathan Glaser thought, and I quote here, if I had to select a single person to stand for East European Jews in America, it would be Abraham Kahn. So what did he mean? Kahn was neither a political leader, a rabbinic authority, business entrepreneur, nor a philanthropist. He was co-founder of the Yiddish daily Forverts in 1897 and its editor from 1903 until his death in 1951. And he was one of really the greatest newspaper men in that great age of newspapers. Kahn described and portrayed the East European Jew in his writings. He embodied the type in his biography, and he spoke on their behalf when he was addressing them directly and also when he was talking about them. So Glaser was himself a man of ideas, and he singled out someone who represented East European Jews in America, which is one of a new breed of American Jewish thinkers. One could call them, I guess, intellectual influencers, using the word of today. So the 22-year-old who landed in New York in June of 1882 was in some respects typical of those who came between 1881 and 1914 as part of the largest migration in all of Jewish history. Young, single, raised in a traditional Jewish home, Ab Kahn couldn't wait to exercise the freedoms that he had been denied in Russia, which included release from Jewish observance, now that he was away from supervision of family and community, and the right to preach revolutionary ideals that were forbidden in his native land. Though Kahn did not have any part in the assassination of Tsar Alexander II in St. Petersburg in 1881, he did belong to those revolutionary circles. And the roundup of suspected radicals in its wake had, it was a thing that dictated his rapid departure from Russia. Now, Kahn's arrival in New York coincided so neatly with the beginnings of unionization in the industrial Northeast that he was almost immediately able to put his Marxist principles to work. And that is exactly what he did. The problems that he encountered were real, of course. They included an overcrowded city, dislocation caused by internal and transatlantic migration, unregulated industrialization, dangerous working conditions, and behind the statistics governing this urban crisis were hundreds of thousands of actual people trying to find work that would give them food and shelter. One of the features that distinguished Jewish immigrant workers from others who crowded the factories and sweatshops was their level of literacy. They reached for something better. And there were many poets in this group. So Morris Rosenfeld, for example, a fellow immigrant who found work in the sweatshops, and he stayed for most of his life a sweatshop worker, composed many poems about those sweatshops and the striving to get beyond them. Oh, quickly, Messiah, come, we are yet bound in slavery's chains, wrapped round and around. Humanity's blood lies in rust on the sword, with no room in the world for the blood that has poured. Out from under the knout, from the wounds that still bleed. O Messiah, come now on your silvery steed. Well, Kahn, he shared this urge to transcend what felt like slavery's chains, but he attributed the oppression to the alleged abuses of capitalism, and he resolved to do something about it. Within a decade of his arrival in America, he had stepped out as a leading spokesman of the growing socialist and labor movements. Kahn describes his first years in America in a 5-volume Yiddish autobiography called Pages of My Life. And two of those volumes were actually translated and are available in English. And many people have written labor history on the basis of those volumes. And he wrote for the emerging Yiddish socialist press, and he became a featured speaker at union rallies. He entered into a lifelong marriage with a highly educated fellow Russian immigrant, Anna Bronstein, that produced no children, as though to rivet him solely to his work. Now, when Janet Hadda, who was unfortunately, the late Janet Hadda, who was a wonderful scholar of Yiddish literature and a practicing psychoanalyst, later set out to uncover a deeper stratum in Kahn's life. She wanted to do a kind of a psychoanalytic study of him, as she did of Isaac Bashevis Singer. It proved to be impossible because she found no deeper stratum. And nothing beyond what he revealed of himself in his volumes. He was more pragmatist than idealist, one would say, more pragmatist than anything else. And as a practical measure, for example, he challenged the social activists to stop making their speeches in Russian as they were doing. When one of them asked, "What Jew doesn't understand Russian?" Kahn replied, "My father, for example." And though he was fluent in Russian, Kahn had the common sense to lecture in the language that most immigrant Jews could understand. Now, Kahn's contemporary and ally, the playwright Leon Kobrin, who certainly could recognize drama when he saw it, he describes Kahn's appearance during a strike in Philadelphia in 1892, in the earliest years, in his earliest years as an activist. Now, the organizers of the rally had tricked some of the girls who were not striking to come to this rally, and he seated them in the front rows just before the speaker was brought on stage. Playing his part to perfection, Khan flew into a rage, stamping his feet, flinging his arms about, and shouting that they ought to be laid down and whipped, skinned alive, for scabbing instead of standing up to the blood-sucking bosses. Now, Kobrin, writing about this, says that he was reminded of the Magid, the preacher of the fiery preacher of Khan's native region of Russia, whose sermons about the hellfire that was awaiting sinners used to be a byword for punishing rhetoric. But Khan's tactic worked, and all these scabbing girls signed up for the union, which is one of the things that made the crowd hail Khan as the prophet of the movement. So this is, gives us a lively picture of those years, which were, in some ways, I would say, even different from the ones in which we live. Anyway, once Khan began writing for the Yiddish press, he adjusted those shock and awe tactics to the harder task of winning a mass audience. Was it possible to issue a daily paper in Yiddish that would nurture an intimate relationship with the masses while also trying to seriously raise their social and cultural awareness? This is a question that was asked by Irving Howe, a socialist of the next generation, who admired how Khan managed it, for example, by editorializing as the proletarian preacher. That's how he signed himself in his weekly newspaper columns, newspaper editorial. And what he did was he used the weekly Torah reading as the basis of his socialist message, right? Of course it worked because Khan deeply felt and shared with his readers that connection between their European past and its values, the Jewish values, and the American future and its values. So he was not cynical about this. He actually was transposing Jewish values into socialist values, the way many, many Jews have continued to do. So Khan is mediator. One of the great and most well-known contributions that Jews have made to the world as a result of their involuntary dispersion was the quickening of trade and commerce in goods, and the same goes for ideas. No Jew ever deserved the title of Vermittler, the Yiddish term for go-between or intermediary, more successfully than Khan did in introducing European Jews to America and America to the Jews. Now, such intermediaries usually work only in one direction, helping those of their native culture adjust to the new one. But Khan became equally adept at familiarizing Americans with his fellow immigrants and helping Jews feel at home in America. On arriving in New York, Khan had determined to become as fully literate in English as he was in Russian, which required mastering everything the cultivated American might be expected to know. He read Dickensian novels, he studied the history of the United States, and after acquainting himself with important American writers of his day, he got to know them personally. English was his fifth language after Hebrew, German, Yiddish, and Russian, and the third language that he used in writing. Even as he was rallying these workers in Yiddish, he was simultaneously placing articles in the local English press. One day, Khan received a note from William Dean Howells, who was a famous New England writer, whom he had been reading with interest. As opposed to Americans like Henry Adams, and later Ezra Pound and T.S. Eliot, who were appalled by the way immigrant Jews were supposedly coarsening America and its language, Howells was curious about the rise of the Yiddish press, and he looked for Khan, sought him out, and found him editing the socialist newspaper Arbeiter Zeitung, workers' newspaper. Kahn admired Howells' novels, so that when the two of them got together, they discussed literature as equals. The young immigrant filling Howells in on Russian literature, and the dean of American letters, which is how Howells was known, encouraging the talented newcomer to publish his own fiction. And that's all the push that Kahn needed. He began writing about immigrant life in English, just as he had been already doing in Yiddish. His biographer, Seth Lipsky, notes that in 1896, Kahn's first novel, called Yekel, A Tale of the New York Ghetto, was brought out in English by Appleton, the publisher of the famous grammar book that Kahn had used to learn English only 14 years earlier. This is quite a wonderful transition. So Kahn obviously did not consider himself part of that ghetto, whose inhabitants he rendered in his fiction speaking broken English and still following old world customs. Literary realism was his way of familiarizing Americans with part of society that they wouldn't otherwise know. Now, in 1897, Kahn founded a new newspaper, the Yiddish Daily Vorwärts, but he quit when it became entangled in a fight for political control. And if you think that infighting in organizations is somehow quite terrible, you ain't seen nothing until you read Kahn and what went on and why it became so fierce that he really felt he had to quit the newspaper that he had founded. But then he made a very bold move. With connections that he had developed through Howells, he joined the staff of the Commercial Examiner, one of the smaller New York papers that specialized in keen local reporting. While he was working at the Examiner, he introduced his fellow journalists to the creative life and personalities of the immigrant community. And one result of that was one of the books that's still being used. It's the book called Spirit of the Ghetto by Hutchins Hapgood, who was one of the great newspaper men of that day. And it describes the ghetto, in quotation marks, the New York ghetto of that day and the fascinating personalities in it, all of whom had been introduced to him by, of course, Kahn. So Kahn realized that he had as much to teach the other journalists as he had to learn from them. And he wrote, my firm convictions and outspoken taste in literature, my passionate interest in art, and the excitable way I used to marshal my arguments, all this was unusual in American discussions about literature. Just see the well-spoken English people with their modulated voices and everything, and this Jew speaking passionately about Tolstoy and Dostoevsky and so forth. So he said, such things are discussed in America in a light, casual tone, but I took them with great seriousness. Thus, my words used to make an impression on my colleagues, and during the afternoon discussions around the long black reporter's table, I was the center. With his Jewish background in Talmudic exegesis, his exposure to Russian literature and political debate, and now to the possibilities of a free press, Kahn created a new cultural amalgam of the American Jewish intellectual. The newspaper was itself a hybrid form of information and entertainment, commerce and ideology, persuasion and accommodation, individual expression for the mass market. And the Yiddish newspaper had further to negotiate between the European past and the American present, between staying Jewish and becoming American. Kahn forged that balance among those competing claims. Now, he was also the mediating novelist, and this is how he became probably best known. After 15 years as a newspaper man, Kahn had become so well known that in 1913, when the popular illustrated monthly magazine McClure's wanted to introduce its readers to the Jewish immigrant world, they went to him, its best known personality, Kahn. The series of articles that Kahn submitted as the autobiography of an American Jew, he then developed into the novel, The Rise of David Levinsky, published in 1917. And this was modeled on Howell's novel, and clearly because the title really recalls that earlier novel, which was called The Rise of Silas Lapham. And it's the story of a simple Vermonter whose rise to wealth as a paint manufacturer precipitates a crisis of conscience that he very nobly resolves at the expense of his business. Now, Levinsky traces a Jewish immigrant who arrives in 1885 with 4 cents in his pocket to become, quote, worth more than $2 million, that's in that day, and recognized as one of the 2 or 3 leading men in the cloak and suit trade in the United States, unquote. Far from touting his originality, Kahn explicitly placed this work in the continuum of American fiction, offering a Jewish version of the familiar rags-to-riches tale, which in American fiction very often ends on that note of, but this is not success at all. So Levinsky is the narrator, tries to put his American readers at ease with the foreign aspects of what he is describing. He writes, because this is written in the first person, Levinsky telling his own story, I understand that some school teachers in certain villages of New England get their board on the rotation plan, dining each day in the week with another family, he says. Well, this is exactly the way a poor Talmud student gets his sustenance in Russia, the system being called eating days. So Kahn explains his intense Talmud schooling back in the old country in a way that flatters the Yankee supporter of education. And he does something similar in describing how newcomers feel about this promised land. He writes, when the discoverers of America saw land at last, they fell on their knees and a hymn of thanksgiving burst from their souls. The scene, which is one of the most thrilling in history, repeats itself in the heart of every immigrant as he comes in sight of the American shores. I am at a loss to convey the peculiar state of mind that the experience created in me, and so on. So when it comes to portraying life on the Lower East Side in this book, Kahn does not try to replicate the speech as he did in Yekyll, because the goal here is to domesticate the exotic and to integrate the alien. Acculturation is not just the subject of the book, but he demonstrates it. It's its demonstration. Kahn was really showing his at-homeness in American culture. The rise of David Levinsky made a great impression on the next generation of Jewish intellectuals, the one in that other series. The Jewish critic Leslie Fiedler, for example, who was born in 1917, the very year that this novel, The Rise of David Levinsky, was published, praised it in 1959 as, get this, a commentary on the rise of the garment industry and its impact on American life, a study of the crisis in American Jewish society when the first wave of German immigrants were being overwhelmed by Jews from Galicia and the Russian Pale, a case history of the expensive spirit involved in changing languages and cultures, a portrayal of New World secularism, which made of City College a third temple, and of Zionism and Marxism, enlightened religions for those hungry for an orthodoxy without God. This novel, all of those things. But Fiedler dug deeper, identifying loneliness as the central feature of the book. Not all those things that he describes, but loneliness. And he says that he considers the vestiges of ghetto Puritanism one of the hindrances that stand between the Jew and his full humanity. So Fiedler himself was then developing a theory about suppressed eroticism in American fiction. And he finds an example of this in Levinsky, whose strongest emotional connection is with his mother, who died in Europe trying to protect him, and for whom Levinsky can never find a satisfying substitute in love or companionship. Levinsky's unsatisfactory relationships with women, and that is how the book is actually structured, unsatisfactory relationships at each stage of his development as a manufacturer. These failed attempts to secure marriage and family run parallel to the success of his business, which suggests that the failure of private life is punishment for the success in business life. And in this way, Levinsky becomes one of Fiedler's texts to prove his theme for the book that he wrote that made him famous as a literary critic, Love and Death in the American Novel. So it's interesting, right, that one generation of intellectuals then really appropriates and interprets and finds new things in the creation of the former. Just one other example of this. A little bit after Fiedler, another American Jewish writer and intellectual finds that Levinsky could not feel at home with his desires and cannot take pleasure in his success because his character was formed by hunger. Now, this is a kind of difficult concept, but intriguing. So bear with me here. He writes, Rosenfeld writing, because hunger is strong in him, in Levinsky, he must always strive to relieve it. But precisely because it is strong, it has to be preserved. It owes its strength to the fact that for so many years, everything that influences Levinsky most deeply, say, piety and mother love, all those things were inseparable from hunger. For hunger, in this broader, rather metaphysical sense of the term that I've been using, is not only the state of tension out of which the desires for relief and betterment spring. Precisely because the desires are formed under its sign, they become assimilated to it and converted into the prime source of all value, so that man, in pursuit of whatever he considers pleasurable and good, seeks to return to his yearning as much as he does to escape from it. Now, like a rabbi commenting on a biblical passage, Rosenfeld thinks that all of Jewish history is marked by this same profoundly Jewish trait, he calls it. The yearning for the land of Israel that runs through Jewish history is that same reflexive desire becoming its own object. The yearning in the Jewish saying, if I forget thee, O Jerusalem, is itself Jerusalem, according to Rosenfeld. And it is to that yearning, most of all, that Jews remain faithful. Now, this insight into Levinsky's character, Rosenfeld extends to the nation for whom return to the land is no simple desire to be fulfilled, he says, but an attachment to yearning that must be preserved. Now, this theory about why Jews remain a diaspora people makes Levinsky into the very embodiment of diaspora man. Now, you get this. It's a very un-Zionistic idea, right? You understand what he's saying here is in all these generations that we were saying, if I forget the old Jerusalem and turning to Jerusalem in our prayers, he's saying that it wasn't really Jerusalem that we were attached to, but the yearning for it. That was what we were attached to, and that became the essence of our being. And this is what he finds in Levinsky. So you see, this book then, for him, assumes really an extraordinary importance, and he connects the insight with something national and much deeper than I'm sure Kahn consciously considered or knew. And Rosenfeld is also struck by how American this feels, because he says Americans are likewise ambivalent about striving and fulfillment. Our favorite representation of the rich is of a class that doesn't know what to do with its money. Levinsky and the American businessmen he represents are lonely because they are able to satisfy everything but the hunger that drove them to strive for success in the first place. He writes, "I'm not suggesting that Jewish and American character are identical, but for Levinsky, who arrived in New York with 4 cents in his pocket, was as unlike as an American as anyone could possibly be. But there is a complementary relationship between the two, which, so far as I know, no other novel has brought out so clearly." So Kahn's novel, begun as an attempt to make the immigrant Jews appreciated by their American compatriots, made the children of those Jews understandable to themselves. They recognized Levinsky's moral kinship, not just with Silas Lapham, the book on which he sort of based this, but with the Great Gatsby, whose deeper theme of loss continues to resonate deeply with the American public. And these interpretations of the novel then become part of its legacy. So, one other facet of Kahn, an immigrant guide. So far, we have shown Kahn introducing Jewish immigrants to their fellow Americans, but he was and he remains better known for having introduced the Jews to America as editor of the Foreword, with the same instinct that Levinsky has for what coat is going to appeal to buyers this season and for how to market it. Kahn found ways to engage his readers by becoming the Foreword's guide to the new American perplexed. Now, Kahn took the idea of an advice column from a rival Yiddish newspaper, and he turned it into the most popular feature of the paper, the Bintel Brief, the bundle of letters in which he answered requests for assistance from men and women who were experiencing every kind of difficulty, from people who didn't know how to use a handkerchief to those who felt guilty about not returning to Russia to help in the revolution. The sellout of idealism was a standard indictment of socialists who were making good in America. And the more the Foreverts made good, the more such criticism was directed at the newspaper and its editor. The Marxist motto stayed on the paper. The ears of the paper are those top corners on the front page. And the ears of the paper read, "Workers of the world, unite. You have nothing to lose but your chains." But Kahn, on the other hand, adjusted his youthful ideology to the actual challenges that were facing Jews and America. One of them, of course, was the challenge of Zionism. And that was relatively easy for him to accommodate because the Jewish socialism on which Kahn had founded the Foreverts was certainly not Zionist in any way, but neither was it really anti, because it acknowledged no necessary contradiction between commitment to the Jewish people and to the international proletariat, or between Marxism and American democracy. What might have seemed a dubious project in 1897 when Herzl founded the Zionist movement, by the way, the same year as the founding of the Foreverts and the founding of the Jewish Socialist Bund, which was anti-Zionist. That idea of Herzl's had become much more credible by 1917 when Britain issued the Balfour Declaration supporting the creation of a national home for the Jewish people in Palestine. By then, the carnage of the First World War that trapped Jewish communities between the warring armies had proven that the Jews needed their own homeland. So Kahn's authority as a man of the left and editor of the world's largest circulation Jewish newspaper meant that when he began to have a growing respect for Zionism, this promoted the movement as a whole. In 1925, when he went to see for himself what was happening in Palestine, his reporting from there was deemed a decisive moment in the history of American Jewry's support for what many considered the Jewish homeland. And leaders of the Yishuv, David Ben-Gurion and others, took heart from his support. And that support of his, what he wrote from Palestine during his month there in September to October of 1925, firmed up ties between the Histadrut, Israel's central labor union, and the non-communist unions in the United States. And meanwhile, the paper kept distancing itself ever farther from the anti-Zionist positions of the Socialist Bund and the communists. So this is an extraordinarily important shift in just one man's perception, but that man being Ab Khan meant that this perception was actually extraordinarily influential in the tide of American Jewish politics. And no less significant than his growing appreciation for the recovery of Jewish sovereignty in Israel was Khan's evolving response to the Russian Revolution, which he originally hailed as the fulfillment of his youthful dreams. In overthrowing the Tsarist regime, the revolution captured the allegiance of many Jews who believed that it would end anti-Semitism and bring peace to the world. Then shortly after came the Bolshevik takeover, which set in motion plans for world revolution propelled by the Communist International. The communists established their first beachhead in New York in 1922 through the Yiddish daily Morgen Freiheit, a rival newspaper, which pretended to be independent while its dedicated editors enforced the Moscow party line. As this happened, the Forward's original response to the revolution, headlines proclaiming it a free Russian people, a free Jewish people in Russia, and Jewish troubles are at an end, that was its original thing, quickly turned to dismay at Lenin's imposition of authoritarian rule, and all that followed, of course. Khan's resistance to communism grew in response to Stalin's dictatorial rule. Now this, in August 1929, the Mufti of Jerusalem incited massive attacks against the Jews of Palestine. One could say that this is where the present began. And Stalin hailed this aggression as the start of an Arab revolution against British and Zionist imperialism. That is where really the language of anti-Zionism, the political impetus of Zionism, that whole concept of Zionism being, you know, an imperialist imposition, like the British imposition, a force of oppression against the native population. This began really as an ideological movement in the Soviet Union. In the heat of the moment, this Soviet support for Arab terror, very much like the reaction of the left to October 7th, shocked many of its Jewish sympathizers into cutting ties with the communist Freiheit and propelled many of its writers and readers to the Forwards. But this didn't last very long. This should teach us something. Didn't last very long, right? Many Yiddishists, for whom the language had become the vehicle for Judaism, and many Yiddish writers who depended on Soviet support, quickly scrambled back into the Soviet fold. And two leading Yiddish poets, Menachem Beresha and Levick, about whom we will be speaking in this series, wrote this: "If with a knife at our throat, we would have to choose you, the Zionists, or the Yevsekten, the Jewish Bolsheviks, we will choose the Yevsekten, not because they please us, because they don't, but they are young, and behind them stands a great and fruitful idea. If they are blind in certain things, they may in time begin to see. They have potential. Your camp is the generation of the desert in every respect. It is perhaps brutal to say so, but your time has passed, in truth, forever. So in the name of progress, and despite their misgivings, they welcomed communist support for Yiddish as the sanctioned language of the Jewish proletariat, and the more Khan discredited Stalinism, the more he was accused of selling out to bourgeois interests and to Zionist reactionaries. So I would say that Khan's most important legacy turned out to be his evolution from proletarian preacher to guardian of America and Zion. As editor of the world's largest circulation Jewish newspaper, he was almost certainly the most influential Jewish voice in America of the interwar years. It mattered enormously that he came to choose Zionism over communism and American democracy over Soviet dictatorship. On September 1, 1939, Germany attacked Poland. Yet for leftist sympathizers, the shock of the Soviet-Nazi pact to divide Poland between them was greater than the invasion itself. If ever the presence of a Yiddish newspaper proved its worth, it was with its coverage of what the historian Lucy Davidovits called the war against the Jews and of the rise of Israel in its aftermath. The historian Rick Richman reminds us of the Madison Square Garden rally in May of 1940. That was after the war had started, but before America entered the war, when New York Mayor Fiorello LaGuardia urged America to stay out of the war. This is, by the way, it was thought to be the Madison Square Garden had in it more people at that time than it had ever held before at that rally, right? So LaGuardia speaks against America's entry into the war, followed immediately by Khan, speaking mostly in Yiddish, urging just the opposite. Hitler must be defeated. Hitlerism is the great curse of the world. And now that Hitler and Stalin are one, both of them must be destroyed. So with the outbreak of war, Khan had vetoed plans to celebrate his impending 80th birthday. The two coincided. And threw himself completely into this effort. But the Forwards insiders insisted on publishing a tribute book. And now from that, I draw the summary of what they thought were his achievements. First, as leader, his fellow former revolutionary, Rafael Abramovich, praised Khan as his strong and determined will, his superhuman energy, his extraordinary stubbornness and tenacity, and an amazing, tireless urge to work, all the indispensable qualities of a pioneer. Now, Khan was very often berated. He was a tough boss. He was sometimes accused of being very, authoritarian in his rule. But this is the tribute to him, as the other side of it is, he was a leader. And this is what he accomplished. As an editor, I know of no case when a newspaper played such a prominent role as the Forwards did in the Jewish workers' movement. Socialists may have found him wanting, but the 10-foot Forward building was erected thanks to Khan's leadership. And that testifies as much to the labor movement that he championed as to the paper's success. That building, by the way, you can still see on the Lower East Side. It's one of the still tallest buildings. It's now a Chinese center, but the Forward was the proudest building, proudest creation for many Jews of the Lower East Side for many, many years. And then he was a creative writer, which we've spoken about, especially in the writing of The Rise of David Levinsky. He was a great literary critic. In his art, he is not a propagandist. As a matter of fact, in the early years, his literary criticism was very influential in bringing certain playwrights and works to the attention of the public, and as a literary impresario, because Khan supported Yiddish writing from the early works of Yud Lamed Peretz, who was still in Warsaw, which he published in America before it appeared in Poland, and to the novels of Israel Joshua and Isaac Basheva Singer. He was the publisher of many, many hundreds of poems, stories, and serialized fiction by some of the finest writers of the interwar years. So these tributes from the people who knew him best acknowledge that Kahn was right when others, themselves included, had accused him of being wrong. One of these writers, whom Kahn had published from Europe and helped to bring to America, singles out Kahn's courage in preparing the immigrant generation for its necessarily difficult transition. This is 1940. We live in a time when all values are being reassessed, and we see the past nakedly. Whoever once counted as a realist, a materialist, turns out to have been an idealist. Whoever preened in his idealism turns out to have been an egoist, thinking only of himself and his interest. Those who fought against the Forwards had least concern for the Yiddish masses in America and elsewhere. So the same qualities that made him a hard editor and unlovable boss helped Kahn withstand assaults from the left, much like those that later were aimed at his successors, the neoconservatives of the next generations. 3 decades after Kahn's death in 1951, Seth Lipsky, one of the boldest newspaper men of our own time, undertook to run the Yiddish Forward in English in Kahn's spirit. Alas, Lipsky was forced out by the old socialist Yiddishist management, who turned it back to the ideas that Kahn had outgrown. Now, Lipsky went on to revive another New York newspaper, The Sun, and he wrote, not so long ago, a very good, inspiring biography of the man who inspired him. So I very much commend it to you, The Rise of Abraham Kahn. It's a wonderful biography with much fuller detail. So let me just end with this passage from The Rise of David Levinsky. When the already successful Levinsky is vacationing at a hotel in the Catskills that serves newly established Jews like himself, the news is so unbearable that when David shuts his eyes, he is reminded of the stock exchange. The poor musicians cannot make themselves heard over the noise, whether they play from Aida or from songs from the Yiddish stage. As a last resort, the conductor strikes up the Star Spangled Banner, and the effect is electrifying on the crowd and on the novel. The few hundred diners rose like one man, applauding. The children and many of the adults caught up the tune joyously, passionately. It was an interesting scene. Men and women were offering thanksgiving to the flag under which they were eating this good dinner, wearing these expensive clothes. There was the jingle of newly acquired dollars in our applause, but there was something else in it as well. Many of those who were now paying tribute to the Stars and Stripes were listening to the tune with grave, solemn mien. It was as if they were saying, "We are not persecuted under this flag. At last we have found a home. Love for America blazed up in my soul. I shouted to the musicians, 'My country!' And the cry spread like wildfire. The musicians obeyed, and we all sang the anthem from the bottom of our souls." Now, intellectuals don't normally strike up the band, but Kahn directed his readers away from the bad and toward the better. It's a direction that many an intellectual today, Jewish or otherwise, could stand to learn from. Kahn, who had moved to America from an autocratic Russia when he was 22, learned to appreciate what a democracy meant. He evolved from wanting the defeat of capitalism to protecting the country from the incursion of communism. He championed civic awareness, translating the Jewish sense of responsibility into an enlarged sense of responsibility for fellow Americans. In becoming more of an American, he simultaneously fought harder for the Jewish people that was under attack from the very same forces that were threatening this country. So whereas The Rise of David Levinsky was a version of the American rags to riches in which success is a form of failure, the rise of Abraham Khan was a story of true intellectual, moral, and practical achievement. I think we celebrate that. Thank you.